Afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity to share this work that we've been in. Basically, it's the last 20, 25 years of what I've been involved in. I'm a spokesperson for 30 or 40 people that's been involved in this. Primarily, it's been Risa Carlson in the archaeology and Jane Smith, an archaeologist out of Petersburg, and Dennis Landwehr, a soil scientist. But there's been many, many people involved in development of this way of looking at the landscape. And so what I hope to do today is kind of give you an idea of how dynamic this place is. We think of the earth that we walk on and enjoy in our travels here in southeast Alaska as being relatively stable when it's anything but. And how that has changed through time and how human interactions would have been on that landscape. When I moved here in 1990, this was the paradigm. We were what I refer to as the wall of ice. If you picked up any kind of text on southeast Alaska that talked about the geology and geomorphology and glacial history, it said we were a wall of ice to the edge of the continental margin. It was 3,000 feet thick until 10,000 years ago, and nothing survived here. It's a great model because you don't have to worry about what happened post 10,000 years. And we started mucking around in the caves on Prince of Wales Island, and that completely changed that paradigm once we started finding what things were on that landscape for both animals and plants, and taking a look at that glacial history and realizing that this was not exactly what had gone on, that it was far more complex than that. And so as you go back in time, there's been many glacial cycles. This is only a tiny fragment of the last like 2.2 million years of glacial cycles on the Earth. And so we're only talking about the last 600,000 years. And each of those blue cycles is a glacial cycle, and each of the yellow ones there is a interglacial period, of which we're in now is what's known as the Holocene. And so all I'm going to talk about today is this little thing right here and what's happened in that part of that cycle. A lot of the history of when the timing of the glaciations and stuff occurred, the slate is wiped clean each time that the ice advances. So it's trying to find bits and pieces of evidence to give us a picture of what's happened through time is really difficult once you get back beyond the last glacial advance. Two really key elements to what I'm going to touch on today is global sea level. Because there was so much ice globally, sea levels dropped somewhere between 120 and 130 meters relative to where sea level is today. That means all of those places that we go out there and fish for lingcod and halibut would have been islands. So you have to think about the landscape differently than you do today when you get back to the last ice age and what has happened then through time. And so this is the global sea level. If you were at Barbados and Tahiti, where you didn't have the influences of ice and the interactions of ice on the landscape. And so it was this curve coming back up. So basically somewhere about 6,000 years ago, sea level in a non-glaciated landscape was relatively stable. The other concept that's really important is what happens when the ice starts interplaying on the landscape. And this is a changing paradigm that has happened with this research, is coming to understand the extent of these. So as the ice moves out on the landscape, it pushes down on the Earth. The Earth is really flexible, especially southeast Alaska, because we geologically are relatively thin. The crust is relatively thin. So there was so much ice here at Juneau, and that pushed down on that landscape. But as that ice grew and moved across southeast Alaska, it rolled up a forebulge out in front. At the same time sea levels were dropping and sea levels were rising, this forebulge migrated back and forth across southeast Alaska. And to figure out where people were living on the landscape, you need to understand the relationship between what that forebulge was doing through time and where sea level was. And that's what we've been able to come up with by getting a large enough data set on the landscape. So you'll hear me talking about the Fore Bulge, and basically Chatham Strait and Eastern Baranof Island is the hinge for that Fore Bulge. Western Baranof Island, Sitka, and islands to the west, Prince of Wales Island and stuff to the south is where that Fore Bulge developed. Not that we didn't have glaciers on the landscape out there. Not that there weren't alpine glaciers and lobes of ice, of the mainland ice coming out on the landscape. But overall, these were the geomorphic processes going on. And I'll try to give you some idea of how extreme that is. What I'm talking about is based on years of hunting down raised marine shell bed deposits. If you've walked around Juneau, you've maybe ran into these. If you go up to the Glory Hole over in Douglas Island, you'll see clamshells in the blue muds. The reason that the Predwell Ditch is where it is, it's the upper limits of the marine clay on the landscape. That's why they dug the ditch where they dug the ditch. And many places along there are shells. If you go to Spalding Meadows, up out of Auk Bay. If you go around Auk Bay itself, around the university, you'll see many of these marine sediments that are uplifted. What I try to, what I've been trying to do is make sense out of the timing of that. And so there are many different places across southeast Alaska. This is Stainy Creek in central Prince of Wales Island, a very important place for fish on the landscape. And we know we have long habitation because of the fish weirs and stuff in the mouth out there. But we, if you go way up Stainy Creek, you've got 8,000 to 9,000-year-old clam beds, and they get younger and younger and younger as you go out. As the land rose relative to sea level today, you can see where that's been through time. And this is what these things look like. They're just like the intertidal muds we find here today, but they're sometimes 3 or 4 miles upstream or hundreds of feet in elevation higher than you would find them on the landscape normally. How many times have we walked in the lower intertidal at a minus tide? And you're walking on these clams that look like they should be alive. They're still in growth position. We're finding those are some of our oldest clam beds that are still exposed above the lowest tide today. For years, I walked over these thinking they were just a few hundred years old and maybe an earthquake or something had lifted these up and no longer was that clam bed there. So making sense out of this, if you've gone up and skied over on Douglas Island, and you go up Fish Creek, and you cross a little bridge there at Fish Creek. If you walk off in the timber, there's a landslide. And in that landslide are 12,000-year-old marine sediments underneath the Edgecombe Tephra. So when Mount Edgecombe erupted, it laid that bed of stuff down. And so you've got diatoms and foraminifera and shells in that marine mud at a really high elevation around the Juneau area. Some of the oldest stuff we found is in behind Ketchikan at the old Loran station. Underneath a lava flow, we found 42,000-year-old marine sediments. And on top of the lava flow, right up here, we found 13,000-year-old marine sediments. So we know the age of the lava flow, and we can take a look at how communities have changed through time. In fact, this is a great research opportunity right here. It's loaded with plant remains as well. It's some of the oldest palynological or plant remains we have in southeast Alaska trapped underneath that lava flow. If you've been to Cake recently, they just built the Seal Point Road. We were driving up the Seal Point Road year before last. They'd gone through this bank of mud. I found butter clams in that bank of mud at 80 meters above present sea level that date to this. So collectively, these tell a story. I try to invite people to become part of it. This is a perfect example of citizen science. We're out there working and fishing on these creeks and hiking on the landscape and finding stuff out there. I gave a lecture in Wrangell. This gentleman dug a place for his boat, and then when he sank the rock there in the corner, found these raised marine shell bed sites in his yard. When they clean ditches, anywhere they clean ditches around here, they're very likely to cut into this. This was at the very end of the road on Metcalf Island. I happened to be there as they were cleaning the ditch, and there was a beautiful clam bed that dated to about 10,000 years ago, and then the beach deposits that went up above that. Somebody fishing up in Rowan Creek found these when he was steelhead fishing, and he reported it after I gave a lecture over in Sitka and stuff. So getting the word out to people on this can help us. I can't get everywhere, neither can the crew of people that's working on this. Somebody doing deer pellet transects over on Kuprinoff Island ran into this shell bed up on Mitchell Creek. And most recently to Groff Bay, just outside of Sitka. Sitka has a much different sea level history because of the amount of ice that was here at Juneau. So what we've been able to put together is a data set of over 450 of these sites across the Tongass, of which we've got radiocarbon dates on probably now approaching maybe close to 300 radiocarbon dates. Some of this is published, some of this is not published, but from that you can start asking questions and starting to draw some conclusions. And so through the wonders of GIS and new computer systems, you can take all the water away from Southeast Alaska and get a landscape that looks like this. It does slow your computer down slightly if you're working on this. And put these things on the landscape and start to ask some questions. So that's where the data set is. All those points right there represent the data that we have. You'll notice there's not much on Baranoff Island. It's twofold. We haven't spent a lot of time looking. There's a lot of wilderness on Baranoff Island and Chichagof Island on the outside, but also it relates to the history of that area. It's just now starting to emerge from the waves. There's a tremendous amount of information at Juneau, at Petersburg, Wrangell, and at Ketchikan, because after the big earthquake in the 60s, Good Friday earthquake, there were studies done at these sites characterizing the type of sediments, and a lot of this stuff was defined. But we can start to ask questions of this stuff. And so the first thing that we want to do is, so like, how old are these things on the landscape? How do the age of these sediments relate on the landscape? And so the stuff in the Juneau and northern Chichagof and Cuberdon Peninsula area is between 12 and 13,000 radiocarbon years old. The stuff in the Stikine area is 11 to 13,000 years old, and the stuff in the Ketchikan area is 12 to 14,000 years old. So it gives us some kind of idea of the timing of ice on the landscape. So why are these at the way we find them on the landscape? The ice came out on the landscape. It pushed down on that land. The sea reinvaded as the ice started to melt, and these organisms got established. And now that land has risen up. So what it gives us is an idea of the timing of deglaciation. When were these fjords and bays available for habitation by organisms? And so this is the minimal age of when those bays would have been available. The thing that always bothered me for years and years and years looking at it, we had nothing out here older than about 10,000 years, actually 9,700. How come I couldn't find the old stuff out here? We looked really hard. You can see there's a lot of data points out here. If you take a look at the elevation that we find these at, they're up to a total of 840 feet of isostatic adjustment in the Juneau area. So you have to think about the Earth being that flexible. I can't wrap my head around it. I can take you out here and show you the deposits and stuff. I can have you age them. You can see the data that we have and understand that the Earth is so flexible that it can bend roughly 900 feet. It may even be greater than that in the Juneau area because the species that we find in those sediments are deep water species. So you have to add the height of that column of water. That might be greater. The ice must have been a little bit thinner in the Stikine area and not quite as thick in the Ketchikan area based on where we find these things on the landscape today. So what this kind of does, and then we've never found anything higher than 18 meters on the outer coast. So this is the dichotomy. So this was always very young and very low elevation compared to the inner stuff. And we could never kind of wrap our heads around why do you see this difference on the landscape. And what it boils down to is you've got an area that's mainly depressed because of the ice. So crustal depression, the ice moved out and this got pushed down and then it bounced back up. And then what happened, as that ice moved out across the landscape, there was a rolling fore bulge that moved back and forth across this outer portion. Not that there weren't glaciers out here, but they were much, much thinner. And with a lowered sea level, this would have been the edge of the land at full glacial time. So there was almost a double amount of the width of Prince of Wales Island off the outer coast that was exposed. And so this was a really dynamic thing going on. So first what we're going to do is take a look at what was going on back here with this, the area of crustal depression. So if I find a clamshell on Spalding Meadows that's 13,000 years old at, let's say, 600 feet above sea level today, 13,000 years ago, sea level was a lot lower. So to calculate the total amount of uplift, I have to figure out where sea level was 13,000 years ago. So I plotted up that Barbados and Tahiti sea level curve and came up with an equation for that slope of that line so that if I find a clamshell that's 12,200 years old, I know that sea level was 62 meters lower than today. So if I find that at 100 meters, the total uplift is the 100 plus the 62, or 162. When I corrected that and plotted all of those stuff on the depression side of the line, these are the sea level curves that I came up with for different places. So Juneau is that big red line in the mainland, Juneau and Douglas. It's on there, and other islands and stuff are indicated. Talking about how dynamic that world is, that in 2,500 years of time, Juneau would have came up relative to sea level some 656 feet. Think what that is. Think about animals trying to get established, plants trying to get established. Think about how communities of both would have been changing on the landscape. What was going on in the shoreline? Salmon trying to get established in those streams. Think about the downcutting in those streams, the deltas that were forming, and how rapid this is on that landscape. This is incredibly dynamic. It was been a very unstable environment for things to get established in. Similarly, down in the Mitkoff area, it would have risen at the same amount of time, basically, about 246 meters or feet. So it was coming up. It ended up in the same place. It was just doing it at a slightly different rate because of the amount of ice that was on the landscape. Applying this, then, if we want to find those cultural sites that would be 10,000 years old, we need to be looking somewhere up to about 40 meters above modern sea level today within that circle. The problem is that what we also need to do is look at where are the clam communities that would have provided food, such as butter clams and cockles and those kind of things, and when did those get established? Because I believe when those got established on the landscape, you also had fish surviving then in those streams associated with it. So there's some kind of an element of the dynamics of the landscape and the availability of that landscape for people through time. If you've read anything about Haida Gwaii, there's a beautiful book down there, which I have in the next slide. But they model this down on Haida Gwaii. And they talk about that they had 120 meters of isostatic depression in the Prince Rupert area, creating 150 meters of uplift on the outer coast. At Juneau, we've got 256 meters minimally of isostatic depression. What did that mean for Baranof Island? Way off the outer coast of Baranof, we have Pahoehoe lavas at minus 180 meters. In other words, ropey lava that had to erupt on the surface. So at some time, that 180 meters out there was fully exposed. That was that fore bulge rolling out across there. I'll touch on the amount of fore bulges that I know had to have existed. And their data, they have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of points to create this sea level curve, which I'll talk about later. If you want to read that, you can pick up this book right here, and it's a beautiful blending of oral traditions and science. And you can take Southeast Alaska and globally replace it whenever they talk about Haida Gwaii and what it was doing with sea levels, ups and downs of the lands and those kind of things, the changing environment. They've done a beautiful job of capturing that. It'd be a great book to write someday. I would like to do that for Southeast Alaska. But we can do these kind of things. So this is Ketchikan today, and on where with the green dots are where we have the raised marine shell beds. And so we could say that about 12,600 years ago, this is the shoreline of Ketchikan. And we can model that really closely. These things are, they repeat themselves across the landscape. Here's Mitkoff Island and the Stikine Delta. There's where the sea level would have been at about 12,400 years ago. And I can also do this through time at 10,000 years and 9,000 years and those kind of things. So we can put the landscape and show what it was and how complex that landscape was. And Juno right here, we've got tons of information about Juno. And we now have the LIDAR for the Juno area, and you can see all of these old shorelines on it. So this is what Juno would have looked like flooded. And so at about 12,500 years ago, this would have been the shoreline around Juno. And we can look at where that shoreline has been through time. So these are how we can recreate those landscapes. So we know that this was fully deglaciated within the bays and the fjords by that time because those organisms are in those muds on that landscape. So on the outer coast and throughout Southeast, we decided to focus on the butter clam because the butter clam, there's several aspects to it that makes it really unique to work on. One, it comes with all the cockles and the other organisms of that intertidal zone. And two, they occupy a relatively narrow zone in that intertidal zone. And these are the things, these are the resources that people use to, as primarily for food and living along the coastline besides marine mammals and other things. So if we could model where these were at through time, we figured we could find out where humans were through time. And so we went in search of that, and the published data showed the range that those clams are in the water column. So I made a few assumptions. One, I said a happy butter clam 10,000 years ago would have occupied the same range in the tidal zone, and two, the tides haven't changed greatly through time. There's probably not exact. There's some assumptions there that maybe not be quite correct, but as a beginning of a model, that's what we used. And so we went in search of where were butter clams and all the rest of these kind of clams in these communities in the landscape. So we used digital altimeters when we would find these deposits because it'd be nice to survey it, but our brush and vegetation here kind of precludes that, and you can pack these. And we tied it to where it was relative to a zero tide or mean low or low water. And so we very carefully started mapping these things throughout all of Prince of Wales Island and the outer islands, trying to model that first. And we came up with this. So if you want to find where 6,000-year-old clamshells were, they were today, they're slightly above the present highest tide. And our oldest clams and stuff were up at about 12 meters above a zero tide today, assuming that a present tidal maximum is a 19-foot tide in southern southeast Alaska is about 5.88 meters. So if you know that the clams get up within a half of a meter above a zero tide and where your flood tide is, then you add your flood tide to that. So this would have been the paleo shoreline, the highest tide on the landscape through time. So I thought, well, let's plot all the old cultural sites that we had before we started this in 2009. And it wasn't an absolute perfect match, but it's pretty close. Madonna Moss's work at Kaufman Cove and stuff right in here, that's in the yellow. And these are all the other sites that were known around southern southeast Alaska at that time. And I said, well, if we want to look for old sites, we need to go here. Where do you and I camp? We pull up with our boats, we move up 3 or 4 feet above the modern high tide, and we go back in the vegetation and we camp. So we need to go look for that spot. So let's go to a spot that we know really well and see if it, we could have predicted this site. So this is Chuck Lake on Hecate Island. In 1985 and 1987, Bob Ackerman and the Akatas from Japan worked at a site that was found because of timber management going on and road construction and wind throw event that happened as a result of that. And we happen to have LIDAR. We have really high resolution bathymetry or digital elevation models that I can ask these questions of on Hecate Island. So I flooded that. And if you take a look, all the cultural sites and stuff fall right on the margins of that flooded seaway. In fact, the 8,220-year-old site is back in this little bay where we would have paddled around and came into a beautiful protected bay on a beach back in there, and that site was 1 meter above, or 3 feet above, what we could have predicted. So we could have predicted the occurrences of these sites by applying this model. So we were pretty excited about that. So we went to Kosciuszko Island, where there had been no previous paleontological or cultural resource surveys, and we also had LIDAR on there, and we had this beautiful bay and estuary system with some old paleo beaches. You can see the old back beach deposits in here, and you got an old alluvial fan going into an estuary right here. And we applied the LIDAR onto that and flooded that up to the elevation that the model would have predicted. And then I use purely subjection. Where would you and I camp, and why would we go there? There's all kinds of fossil butter clams and stuff within these areas that are yellow. This would have been a salt chuck raging through there. This island, which today is not an island, would have protected us from the fetch of the sea if our families would have came in and there was a nice flat right there we would have camped. So you have a high-energy area where you could have caught fish. You had a huge flat back in behind where you could have trapped fish and also got all kinds of intertidal food sources. And so we picked that area to focus on. So in 2009, we went into the modern bay that's out here and walked a half mile into the beach and climbed up to the appropriate elevation of about 60 feet. This is what it looks like today. And here's what this flat terrace looks like. And there's nothing at the surface at all exposed. And I grabbed the shovel and I said, you just got to believe. And we dug down 42 centimeters and dug into a 9,100 to 8,700-year-old cultural site that covers that entire flat. So there was nothing exposed at the surface. This is contemporaneous with Chukaka or On Your Knees Cave. These people knew each other. So this was really, really a huge moment for applying this model on the landscape. There's been very minimal testing done at this site. 2 days later, found us on Hecate Island at Rice Creek when Bob Ackerman had proposed that there had to be some upper terraces on there. And once I modeled that, I went back. It's all limestone. And in the deer trail there, I found that obsidian. Underneath that obsidian was charcoal that was 9,000 years old, and they actually occupied it for 3,000 years at that site based on the dates that we got. Adjacent to that were three more terraces at different places over a mile and a half where there's cultural sites out on Hecate that's been now predicted by this site or by this model. Canoe Point, south of Craig. Working on a totally unrelated project, I got out and saw these beautiful terraces, went up to the upper terrace and was walking down this deer trail and saw that flake right there, and did this test pit out in here and came back with the same age as the stuff from Chuck Lake, back to so basically 8,200 to 7,100 radiocarbon years ago. For occupation on this site, the middle terrace has 3,000 to 4,000-year-old sites on it, and the bottom terrace has modern or maybe several hundred-year-old cultural sites on it. So this place has been occupied at this spot on different terraces for somewhere in the vicinity of 9,500 calendar years. Tremendous amount of time on the one place on the landscape. We flooded the main part of Prince of Wales Island on Staney Creek. And 3.5 miles up from modern shoreline in there, we came across this site that covers something like 5 acres. and it dates from basically 7,000 years to 4,200 years. This was an enormous village site on what was then the stable shoreline of Stany Creek. We went back to look at Irish Creek, which is in Rocky Pass. So we had the tools that suggested this had to be really old, but we didn't. They hadn't dug it in the 80s as we would approach it today. So we went back and took a look at that, and this came out at 9,280 to 8,800. So basically, this has an age of about 10,500 calendar years ago on the landscape, and there's four terraces at this site that all show occupation. These are almost all microblades. We found very little bifacial material at these. Incredible. I'd still to this day as a geologist have no idea how you strike a blade like this off of a quartz crystal. And the obsidians and the cherts and the materials that come out of there, the fine grain chalcedonies and the rhyolites, is quite varied across the landscape. A little bit of a piece of a biface there, and large argillite from the outer islands and stuff. A lot of cores, microblade cores. This last year, you may have heard on Highway 43 on Prince of Wales Island in December. Last year, I took my family out for a drive when their in-laws were visiting, and I drove across the new road construction, and I went, that peat is way too dark. And I got out and looked, and what you have is a compacted glacial till, a beach deposit right there, and then a charcoal-laden cultural horizon above that. When you model Yaddick Creek, it's a beautiful fault line. We have a shell deposit up here that's 9,430 to 8,500. I believe Madonna Moss was just here talking about the herring. This is where the oldest herring bones come from. That thing's loaded with herring bones and Pacific sardines and like 30 different types of fish bones in those marine sediments. So when I modeled this and stuff, this is where that road cut is. This is the narrowest place. In the fire hearse at Yaddick Creek, we have abundant marine mammal bones in that cultural site. That dates back to 7,880 radiocarbon years. If you think about it, this is the narrowest point where they put the bridge across there. So when the marine mammals would go back in, when the herring were spawning back in there, you could easily have blocked that off and captured those marine mammals or harvested them when they came out using something that was where they had microblades in that site. The other interesting aspect of the Yaddick Creek site is that I don't know if we are in a structure. I don't know if this is prepared service or whatever, but from about 4 miles away, they brought red sandstone flags in and almost set like a tile floor around the hearse. And this is the first time that we've seen anything like that in a cultural site in Southeast. They also were using marine mammal bones and flaking them to make implements from. Not very far from there at Sarkar, they were excavating, and they cut in to build a chase for a culvert last year and kicked up these clamshells. So I'm driving down the road, and I see these clamshells sitting up in the little bank up there where they kicked them out with a bucket. And I said, well, now, if I'm a happy butter clam and I know where I'm at in my water column just about 5 meters above this should be a cultural site. And we walked up. And there was another cultural site close to the outflow of Sarkar. We went over the rise and went to the next area. So there's the bridge. The one I was just looking at is on the backside of that. And where they'd done the grubbing and the clearing here, this is the first terrace down here. This is the second terrace there. There was another site at that place where those folks are looking right there. And we found obsidian and chert in that road construction. If you flood Sarkar, if you're familiar, so here's Yaddick Creek right there. So here's that fault line, and these are where our raised marine shell bed sites are. And if you flood that, all of Sarkar would have been ocean, clear back up in the interior part of Prince of Wales. These are where these two new sites are. We can even get more precise because we had LIDAR done for the road project on that, so we have very, very detailed topography. And so if you look close, this is what Sarkar outflow looks like today. This is what it would have looked like basically 9 to 10,000 years ago. These are the cultural sites here. So they were just right up above this. There's the old shoreline. This is where the marine shell was. This would have been an embayment. And this would have been a salt chuck again coming out of a huge bay in the interior part of Prince of Wales Island. And this gives you what the age is on there. 8810, concurrent with Chuck Lake and the stuff down at Canoe Point. And this one here is concurrent with the age on the stuff down at Yaddick Creek. So this is what we started with in 2009. This is where you find the clams. This is where we estimated the shoreline was. This is what we knew about. This is what we found as a result of applying the model, which I've interpreted. And then I went back also. So the diamonds here, these diamonds right here are the sea caves. And so for years we thought we should be able to go to the outer coast and find incredible antiquity in the sea caves out there, but we never found anything older than about 4,500 years. Well, the reason was that had not emerged yet out of the shoreline. So it wasn't available for habitation until about 4,500 years ago. We didn't know that when we started 20 years ago looking at them. So we've interpreted that as this, being an upper terrace or elevation of occupation, that basically if you want to find the 9,200 to 6,000-year-old cultural sites, you can go to this elevation right here. And the middle terrace and stuff is here. So these people could have never camped here because this hadn't came out of the ocean yet relative to sea level today. Conversely, if I plotted up most of the cultural sites we know about it, this would be an enormous cloud down here. So this is the last 1,800 years or 2,000 years of habitation is at where just above modern sea level today. These people couldn't have lived here because this wasn't available for them. This is these groups of people going back up at different elevations. You can always go back and camp higher when it always is available. So this is the model that we're applying on the ground out there today. I'm trying to expand this up into southern Baranof and southern Kuprinov. So before we started in 2009, there was five sites dating to over 7,000 years in southeast Alaska. These have been found by building a fish hatchery, road construction, timber management, somebody inadvertently stumbling on Chukaka, or what we know as On Your Knees Cave, and those things. Since 2009, by predicting where to go, we found 17 sites that are older than 7,000 and hundreds of other sites that were younger. If we want to find, because of where sea level has been through time and rising, if we want to find our oldest sites in the lower intertidal, we could come across some sites that would be flooded and be like 10,000 years old. Those that are 10,500 and younger and older today lie beneath the waves just because of our uplift and the collapsing of that forebulge. Here's the sites that we've found. So the sites that were known about were the Thorn River site, Chuck Lake site, Chukaka, Hidden Falls, and Groundhog Bay. We found these sites as a result of going back and taking a look at that. So you can start asking questions about dispersion on the landscape. So this is by 10,500 calendar years ago, these sites were occupied. All of these sites have material from the two obsidian sources on Sumez, the argillite on Warren Island, the rhyolite from southern Kuprinov Island, the agate and the quartz crystals from Rocky Pass, and the radiolarian chert from out there. So these people had been on the landscape long enough to find all those sites and develop trade back and forth from those sites throughout all of southeast Alaska by 10,500 calendar years ago. So this gives us some kind of idea at least where the dispersion of people had to be by that time. There's two projects going on right now. There's the road being built to Kassan. I was down there when they were cleaning the ditches, and I came across some middens and stuff down in here and modeled that shoreline. Ann Polnow is working on this right now. So there's a raised marine shell bed right there and two cultural sites here. But we went out the other day, and basically there's a cultural site on this beach here, and there's a cultural site on this beach right back up in here that we don't have ages on yet. So this is a ways of applying this to modern projects that are going on. They're talking about paving this road into Whale Pass, and so I modeled the shoreline virtually when they cross at the where the Neck Lake Fish Hatchery is that Sarah has, all the way into Whale Pass. That entire road system is sitting on or near that paleo shoreline. And so these are ways that taking a look at where we actually need to do intense cultural resource surveys on that landscape. And I've circled those red areas as the high probability areas. This is not just Southeast Alaska. Wherever you had continental crust, relatively thin continental crust, marginal to big blankets of ice, such as in Ireland, Scotland, and England, this is what the shoreline would have looked like 16,000 years ago there. Here was the shoreline at about 8,000 years ago, and at about 7,000 years ago, and the modern shoreline in tan. So the same kind of forebulge and processes, and if you look at the people there that were coastally adapted, marine adapted people were doing the same kinds of things, and their village sites and stuff were changing as this sea level was changing in this area here. I'm sure all the way along the Gulf of Alaska, when you get out to Kodiak and up north, the same processes are going on. We've just not taken a look at applying this strategy on the landscape. And it's all going to be different based on the thickness of the ice, how thick the crust is, what kind of fault patterns there are, and the movements and stuff that goes on along those fault lines. A whole other lecture I could give you is what I've got submarine. But I have, just to kind of get an idea of how, are we anywhere near Haida Gwaii and the studies that they did, throughout all of Southeast Alaska, I've found a, where the fetch of the sea on the edge of that forebulge had to be greatest, I have found a terrace. Well, if sea level only dropped 120 meters globally, to have a terrace at a minus 165 meters means I had to have at least 45 meters of forebulge off the outer coast of Prince of Wales. In the Gulf of Escabel, I've got a sill that floods at 10,000 years ago at minus 70 meters. At Sitka, in Sitka Sound, I have a basin that flooded at 11,330 at minus 133 meters. So there's all of the above shoreline stuff I have with the forebulge. Here's the two points I have down here. If you take the Canadian data, here was the stuff that Heinrich Johans published in 1997, the blue line. In 2004, here's the stuff that Renee Hetherington and stuff put out. So you can see that we're totally within the realm of possibility. There's what your global sea level would. So what's the difference between that? Here's the Barbados-Tahiti sea level. Here is our sea level. Why is ours so much steeper? Ours is steeper because you had a collapsing forebulge at the same time water was rising because the ice was melting. So the perception is a much, much greater sea level rise. So what did that mean to the people that were living on there? If you and I would have been 10,000 years ago on the shoreline and we lived to be 50 years old, sea level would have rose 10.2 feet in our lifetime. What's the oral tradition? The tide grew higher and higher. Where we were camping a few years ago, it was no longer accessible to us when we went back. So they moved their camps up to that highest thing, and then as the sea and the land relative to each other kind of came to equilibrium, they moved their camps back down to where the modern shoreline is today. And that's what this model predicts, and that's what it shows. So I can take a look at what sea level might, or Southeast Alaska might have looked like at full glacial. But then because we know where the organisms are in the marine muds, we can also look at what Southeast Alaska would have looked like at about 14,000 calendar years ago or somewhere about 12,500 radiocarbon years ago. what you immediately see is the Stikine River was a fjord almost back up to Telegraph Creek. The Taku, Portland Canal and those things. When people were coming into Southeast Alaska, they might not have been paddling down rivers. They were coming down the fjords. Admiralty Island was a multitude of islands. Southeast Alaska, if you look at Cleveland Peninsula and stuff, it was a multitude of islands. Same with Garvina Island outside, and Annette Island outside of Ketchikan. You still have the Four Bulge out here, so you have this huge coastal area that's out here. So this was a really dynamic place. And so this wasn't the wall of ice that people came into. This was a really open, exposed place with plants and animals and vegetation growing on these and changing climates through time. And it's been just incredible to almost an awakening for me as a geologist to see how this played out, what we started kind of doing the modeling and asking the questions and that kind of stuff. So I would like to be able to say that we've got all of the paleo shoreline stuff figured out up in here. We're really good right up till we get about the northern tip of Prince of Wales Island and southern Kyu, and we're really focusing on this area. We're moving on up north. And so that's where the research is going and where it's headed, is trying to figure out that history. We know folks were on the landscape because we have Hidden Falls and Groundhog Bay up on Coubertin Peninsula. We just haven't been able to put the pieces together in between. So this is really, really an exciting, for me, it's an exciting way of looking at the landscape. And again, I'm just the spokesperson for a ton of people that's been involved in this. There's many, many other aspects that I could go on for hours on. The whole submarine thing, what we think we found out about paleoclimates as a basis of looking on these sediments and stuff. And there's a lot of ancillary stuff. But this is the gist of it, that this is a really dynamic place. And people have been on the landscape for a long time. And they knew where those resources were and were moving them around. And I think there was way more people here than had ever been thought were here based on the size of these sites that we're finding. Thank you very much. Any questions? Any answers?
What is LIDAR?
LIDAR is a topography that comes off of laser pulses out of a plane. A plane flies over and it shoots hundreds of thousands of pulses out of an array. And it's got a machine in there that actually keeps track of the pitch and yaw of the plane and stuff like that relative to the ground. And as the LIDAR, as that laser pulse goes down through, it bounces off. First, it never hits the very pinnacle of a tree, but you get a first return off the first branch. Then you get hundreds of returns as it goes down through the forest, and you get a final return, which is the bare earth. So you could subtract all of that other stuff off, and you end up with a topography of the bare earth with the vegetation stripped off of it. And what it's done for me, instead of having a form line that we call a topographic map, basically that kind of shows you where the ridges and the valleys were, you can get down to 3 to 4 foot of accuracy in our vegetation here, which is tremendous. You could actually know where you're at in the landscape by the topographic map that you have. You just should have had published here really high-grade LIDAR for all of Juneau and Douglas. And I know I've looked at the stuff for the experimental forest out north, Cowie Creek out there. And you can see all of these fossil beaches and stuff in that Cowie Creek stuff. I don't know if it's available online or if it's the Juneau Borough has it. I've got copies of it. So I think most of this area has been, and so I believe that all of those old shorelines used to show up around here and stuff, but we've modified them. That's what we build our houses on, and that's where they build the Treadwell Ditch, and we've been utilizing those landforms and those kind of deposits around Juneau for a long, long time.
Jim, I know the Juneau Road System's online because I was looking at it the other day, and I just pulled it up from home on the internet, so it is available online.
You got to have, to bring that LIDAR in, I know you've got to have quite a bit of a computer. It bogged mine way down when I brought it in. But you can start asking questions of it through time. That the important thing that's happening in the Juno thing is realizing that the types of organisms that we're finding in the muds here at 600 feet in elevation are organisms that live in 300 feet of water. So when I'm thinking we might have only had 700 to 800 feet of isostatic rebound here, it might be closer to 1,000. Because we've never had a full study of... So not only do you have all of the little clams and worms and barnacles and the other thing, you also have all the microorganisms in those muds, the foraminifera and the ostracods and the radiolarians. For instance, the one that's up on Douglas, as you're going up towards Fish Creek up there, the radiolarians that are present in those muds suggest pack ice. They're radiolarians that rain down underneath sea ice. And so you can, if somebody went in and took the time to study this, you can get temperature and salinity and depth and a whole multitude of information out of the, if you ever need this, I have cases and cases in my office of muds from out southeast Alaska. I'm waiting for students. Much to my wife's chagrin, I got them out of the garage, though. They're now in the office. Yeah.
I'm wondering what your predictions are for sea level in...
I'm sorry, ma'am. My hearing is...
No worries. I'll speak up. I'm wondering what your predictions are for global sea levels for the next, 200 to 1,000 years.
Right now...
That's not a loaded question.
I know that's not. Right now are still... isostatically rising landscape combined with the benefits that we get from the Queen Charlotte Fault, even though we have earthquakes, that our uplift rate right now is slightly faster than the global sea level rising. So right now we're out gaining it. But the rate of isostatic adjustment here at Juno is definitely slowing, and I don't know if our tectonic uplift is constant through time. So basically, we're showing that those cultural sites were roughly at about 18 meters or something on the outer coast. That is how much tectonic uplift you've had in the last 9,000 years. So that is not glacially induced uplift. That's tectonically induced uplift. As glaciers melt faster, that should raise or increase increase to be faster than our uplift rate is right now. So currently, right now, we are rising higher at a faster rate than the sea level is rising. Not everywhere. There's been reports somewhat substantiated that in the Petersburg area, as a result of the January 5th, 2013 earthquake, of actually places that might have gone down as much as 12, 14 inches. Or people that no longer can people utilize their docks, so they've actually had uplift back in there. So you've got to realize that Southeast Alaska has many faults throughout it, and those faults all work in relation to one another, even though there's not a lot of movement along them, so that uplift and the flexure of the earth is not constant across all of Southeast Alaska.
Up in northern southeast around Glacier Bay and Hoonah area, I'm a kayaker. It is amazing what I'm seeing. I mean, places I used to paddle through all land.
Yeah, so that's still rising at a tremendous rate, rapid rate. And there's some really good publications and stuff on how much that is. I know there's a project going on right now to put very, very high-resolution GPS stations throughout all of Southeast Alaska to actually look at what that rate of uplift is. And from that, then they'll be able to tie that to current sea level rise. Dave.
Yeah. When are you going to begin investing in a submersible?
You know, if you would like to donate to the Jim Bechtel Benevolent Fund. Oh, I mean, it's tremendous. So I don't know if you know it now. If you go to the NOAA webpage, there are all this high-resolution multi-beam bathymetry. Nobody does the lead line surveys. Everything is basically like LIDAR of the bottom of the ocean. And the things that are coming off of there, the landforms that are coming off there, I don't know if you remember a couple years ago I identified a new volcano back in Misty as a result of those surveys. There was this beautiful volcanic cone on the bottom of the, right close to New Eddystone Rock back in behind Ketchikan, that had to have erupted post-glacial because there was no erosion on it. We actually took Barb Morgan's Oceans Alaska submersible out there and gathered a sample of rock off of that and looked at the sponges that were growing on top of that. So there's a tremendous amount of opportunity to do submarine stuff. It's just so hard to pinpoint that, although the Canadians have been incredibly lucky. The first thing they did in Canada is identified the most likely place that a cultural resource would be on the bottom of the ocean. They went out with a great big grab bucket and went down and pulled up a flake in those sediments, definitely a worked flake, with a barnacle growing on the flake where it had set on the beach, and they could date the barnacle. Well, we're not there yet, Dave. Questions?
I was really struck by the continuity, long-term continuity of human settlement in this area that you're finding evidence for. I was wondering if you had seen cultural features that are related to kind of the classic Northwest Coast culture, like fish beer complexes and things further upland than we've known about today or any other kinds of things like that.
I think fluvial processes erode and cover a lot of that stuff. I think they might have been there, especially the stoneware. So now we've got, actually, if you go back to, I love PowerPoint, by the way. If you go back and you notice that the global sea level curve and our sea level curve all stabilizes at about 5,500 years, right there. That's where we see Jane Smith has identified the oldest wooden stakeware site in around the Petersburg area at about 5,500 years. I think what happened at that time is the landscape and the sea level all came into some almost equilibrium. That also happens to be about the time that our climate changes to the beautiful climate that we have today. So before, throughout 10,000 years to about 6,000 years, I've got a lot of evidence out of these muds that suggests that we were as much as 3 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit warmer with half of the rainfall, and that fire was part of our ecology. So these people were in a totally different environment than we're in today. And somewhere about 5,500 years ago, you start seeing sphagnum moss, you start seeing the cedars show up in the pollen and stuff like that. The sea level balances. Fish probably started getting established in big numbers in the streams. The streams no longer were being as dynamic and downcutting, and the sea level was no more rising, and the land and the sea basically had come to some kind of an agreement to let something survive on the landscape. And I think people began to greatly flourish at that time. That's when we start seeing, I believe, some of the bigger settlements on that middle terrace, and the fact that that's where we start seeing fishing structures. So before that, because of the dynamics of what was going on in the landscape, if there were fishing structures, they're either buried under deltas or were eroded away. Not that people weren't using them on the landscape. I believe they were. But it would just, it'd be a unique situation that we would find where something today would cut down through a much higher delta that had covered something and buried it.
Any other questions? What about the other larger mammals? Did you find any? You mentioned the brown bear in the cave earlier.
So go to Tim Heaton, Southeast Alaska webpage on caves if you've not, and he will list all of the stuff. So basically, I'll give you a nutshell version, mainly from On Your Knees Cave, what we know of, but from 28 different caves. We've now cataloged close to 60,000 bones from Southeast. So before the last ice age, we were a tundra-dominated landscape, maybe about like Kotzebue. And we had brown bear and wolverine and caribou and black bear, heather vole, lemming. You can help me out here, Dave. I think I've got most of those covered. Saiga antelope. Saiga antelope on there. And then we go into full glacial. During full glacial, what we see is Arctic fox going out and scavenging from some large land carnivore, the remnants of ring seal and marine mammals. So we have Arctic fox bones in the caves and in your knees, and we have all kinds of ring seals. So off of southeast Alaska, southern southeast Alaska, we had pack ice that ring seal were having their young on. Probably polar bears were eating on those ring seal. The Arctic fox was going out and scavenging off of those and bringing those back in. Then as we come out of that, we're more like Dillingham, like kind of maybe a... It's still tundra, but more of a kind of a spruce sphagnum tundra type of thing, wetter tundra, like Bristol Bay. So we still have brown bear, we have Arctic, we have red fox, we have caribou on the landscape, we have black bear on the landscape, and the small mammals tell us that it was a wetter, colder climate. And somewhere at about 10,500 years ago, you start seeing, 11,000 years ago, you start seeing the spruce come in, and you change to a warmer climate. The first Sitka black-tailed deer we see shows up at about 8,800 years ago, something like that. The youngest caribou we have is 10,002. In southern southeast Alaska, the youngest brown bear that we have on Prince of Wales Island, where they aren't anymore, is 7,250 years ago. Part of the dynamics of this, and this is about, so nobody understands how come Admiralty Chichagof and Baranof in the mainland is the only place that have brown bears today compared to the places that only have black bears. If you think about the dynamics of that, because of the collapsing forebulge, we were losing our estuaries and not developing the estuaries the same time that here you guys were rising up incredibly and forming these enormous grass flat sequences in the north end, and the habitat, the brown bear habitat, that's what they're looking for. And it may be just simply a change in the use of habitat from what was off the outer coast, as that forebulge was basically you're losing land here and you're gaining land here, and they might have just changed their location on the landscape. It might be that simple. So we've changed from a wet or a dry tundra to a pack ice to a herb tundra to a drier forest with fire in it to the wet forest of about 5,500 years old that we have today. At about the time when the Bering Land Bridge and the Bering Sea finally got big circulation going back and forth between the North Sea, it set up this thing called the Aleutian Lows, and we started getting the weather that we love so much today. But that all happened right about here. So the land and the sea and the weather, everything combined to make this perfect environment that we live in. And that's why we're here.
Jim, do you, I'm not familiar with this literature, you know the literature of salmon? When did we start seeing more salmon on the landscape?
We don't know. I know the Yaddick Creek muds have got salmon at 9,500 years. Chris Gonzalea did her work looking at chum salmon populations and the genetics, suggesting that the western side of Prince of Wales Island had much more genetic diversity, therefore longer persistent salmon. So my idea is, on that coastal plain that we had out here, that we had our salmon populations and we had pockets of forest and stuff out there. You know, we just found that tree on Kruzoff that was 11,300 years old. So I think that we still had forest, and we still had our salmon and stuff was here, and as that ice melted back and the landscape changed, that the salmon took advantage of...
That might have been why the brown bear were out there, too.
But you've got to remember, if this was a product of forebulge, this was rapidly dropping into the sea because of it being flooded at the same time that this was all rising up. And so you would have been developing those kind of estuarian sediments and systems up in here while you're just rapidly losing it out here. That's a hot spot. We're dynamic. you think about this thing that we live in being somewhat stable, when in fact, if the cedars are only 5,000 years ago that they occupied southeast Alaska, maybe that cedar tree is only the 10th generation on the landscape. So, Thank you.